Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Arizona has become a more competitive political state in recent years. We'll find out why.
And a new book documents the story of Winnie Ruth Judd, Phoenix's famous trunk murderess.
But first this morning, Arizona is getting a whole lot of election attention this week. Both vice presidential candidates are in Arizona tomorrow. First Lady Jill Biden will be here this weekend, and Vice President Kamala Harris is coming back to the state on Thursday.
It all cements Arizona's status as an all-important swing state where polls remain tight as early voting gets underway. We're being bombarded with political ads. The major candidates are on the news and on our favorite podcasts. They're everywhere.
So let's turn now to a conversation about the ways in which these politicians try to represent themselves in their own memoirs and books.
Now, you might think political books and think ghostwriter or propaganda or worse, but our first guest this morning thinks about them very differently.
I actually think that these critiques miss the point entirely of reading these books, because no matter how carefully politicians sanitize their experiences, their life stories, their records, no matter how diligent they are about presenting themselves in the most electable and confirmable and favorable light, they always end up revealing themselves in their own books, in their own words. They tell us who they are. They can't help it. Politicians love to talk about themselves.
That is Carlos Lozada, a Pulitzer Prize-winning opinion columnist for The New York Times, who literally wrote the book on how to read political books. It's called The Washington Read.
Even the pundit Chris Matthews wrote once that even Washingtonians don't actually read these books. They just give them The Washington Read, which means you just skim them, or you look up your own name in the index to see if you're mentioned. And depending on how you're treated, you may decide you, quote, like the book or not.
He reads everything in politics, from memoirs to transcripts to reports, and he finds out a lot about politicians in them. So I got him on the line to find out more about what he's read about the two political figures at the center of the political world right now, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Her memoirs were published a decade apart, but in many ways they're worlds apart. Her first book was published in 2009. And it was all about her experiences as a prosecutor. And it was called Smart on Crime. And she was a kind of mainstream, you know, tough on crime prosecutor. And it is all the kind of thing that 10 years later, when she was running for president in 2019 and published a new book, it was all the kind of stuff that would be very unpopular at that moment in the sort of 2019-2020 Democratic Party. She's much more willing to talk about the negative history of prosecutors in America, how the prosecutorial role has been used for ill as well as for good. And so you see a real transformation between the way she saw her job and her role in her career in 2009 and the way she saw it in 2019.
You also mention when you've read the two Kamala Harris memoirs, an omission that she left out in a particular story that I think says a lot. And I'd love for you to talk about that.
Yes, this is a case that she prosecuted early in her career against two adult men who had sexually assaulted a teenage girl. Mm-hmm. She discusses this story in both of her books. And what she explains in the first book is how she felt that the girl's attitude in the courtroom, the way she dressed, she was chewing gum, she kind of gave off the vibe that she just wasn't interested in the proceedings at all, how those potentially could backfire on her. You know, she worried that the jury would find her not credible as a result. And so before the girl testifies, Harris pulls her aside and says, look, you're kind of hurting your own cause. You're making it harder for me to help you. Right. Now, 10 years later, she tells the same story of the same case, but she skips the moment, which in the first book was pretty significant, the moment when she pulls the girl aside and gives her this kind of tough love. And I found that utterly fascinating because the second book came in a moment. It came sort of, you know, after the Me Too movement had emerged, you know, after we thought differently about the rights of victims, blaming the victim. And it seems to me that Harris decided to skip this story, perhaps because she knew it wouldn't play as well in 2019 as in 2009. Mm-hmm. And I really wish that she had talked about it because it would have been fascinating to hear her say, you know, now I wish I hadn't had that conversation with her, or I would have done it differently, or it was the right conversation to have. She needed to hear it. You know, just to hear Harris grappling with it would have been far more interesting to me than to simply have her skip it altogether.
Okay, so let's talk about Donald Trump, the author of many books. His most famous, I think, the one I always think about is The Art of the Deal, which came before kind of his political career. Tell us a little bit about your reads of Trump's books.
Yes, so in 2015, when Trump was first doing well in the polling for the Republican nomination, I thought, you know what, I should just read a bunch of his books. You know, like, who knows what I'll find in there. I find that even ghostwritten books, as I've said, can be very revealing. So I read eight of them. I read eight of his books,
wow,
including, of course, the Art of the Deal. And what is fascinating is that if you had read those books back then in 2015, it's not that I, like, you know, I had some great foreshadowing. It's just that I saw it all there, you know, the bouts of anger and sometimes insecurities, willingness to stretch the truth, to attack his enemies at all costs. You know, it's all present in his own books.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one moment, actually not in The Art of the Deal, but in a later book called How to Get Rich, that I thought was extremely revealing about Donald Trump. He has this passage, and it's about his hair. And he says this. He says, "The reason my hair looks so neat all the time is because I don't have to deal with the elements. I live in the building where I work. I take an elevator from my bedroom to my office. The rest of the time, I'm either in my stretch limousine, my private jet, my helicopter, or my private club in Palm Beach. If I happen to be outside, I'm probably one of my own golf courses, where I protect my hair by wearing a golf hat." Now, to me, what that reveals, aside from, you know, potentially Trump's vanity about his own hair, is that he lived a life of complete isolation, right? He lives where he works. His only contact with the world is, like, you know, through the windows of his limos, of his helicopter. People say that the White House puts presidents in a bubble. But just from this passage, it seems to me that Trump lived in a bubble of his own making long before he ever came to Washington.
Oh, so interesting. You say, Carlos, that you can tell a lot from the acknowledgments section of a political memoir like this, of all places. Why?
Yes. Acknowledgments are a great place to spot the debts that politicians have incurred over their careers. You know, who they thank, who they suck up to, their donors, their backers, sometimes who they snub, who they omit in their acknowledgement sections,
mm-hmm,
can also be very revealing. I'll give you a couple of examples. One is in a 2015 memoir by Senator Marco Rubio.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts off saying first that he thanks his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, whose willingness to die for his sins will give him eternal life. That's, mm-hmm, you know, that's a wonderful religious sentiment. And then my very wise lawyer, Bob Barnett, right? And Bob Barnett is sort of like a major power broker lawyer in Washington for politicians and media figures. It doesn't get more establishment than Bob Barnett.
Okay.
It's just wonderful to me. I was so happy when I read this because it just captured the inside-outside game that politicians play, like, you know, beating your chest about Jesus in the first sentence and then thanking your totally insider Washington power lawyer in the second sentence.
What a contrast,
you know?
Yeah.
And the other acknowledgments section that I want to highlight came from Joe Biden's second memoir. It was called Promise Me, Dad, and mm-hmm, it covered the period of his life when he was vice president of the United States under Barack Obama, and also when his son Beau was ill and dying. And I happened to be reading it around the time that the famous special counsel report on Biden's handling of classified documents, mm-hmm, came out. And this was the report that had that one line that everyone remembers. It said Biden would come across to a jury as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory.
Right, of course, right? Yeah.
And Biden got really upset about that quote. And he gave a press conference where he was sort of lashing back. He was very upset because the report suggested that Biden couldn't remember the year that his son, Beau, had died.
Right.
Now, in the acknowledgments of that book that covers the illness and death of Beau Biden, Biden said something to me that was utterly fascinating. He said that, look, this was a very difficult period of my life to look back upon. Mm-hmm. And as a result, some of my memories from that period were muddled. Actually, the word he used is that they were sometimes foggy. Mm. And then he says there were a number of people I counted on to help me with recall, with the reconstruction of chronologies, with encouragement. And to me, that sounded so much more real. I mean, any of us who has been through the prolonged illness and death of a loved one, which is most of us, yeah, knows that there are moments, there are memories that you kind of block out, that, you know, you might be talking to another relative and you remember things differently,
yeah,
remember moments differently. And that's completely natural, completely believable, incredible. And I remember thinking, like, why didn't Biden just say something like that?
Hmm. Well, Carlos Lozada, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Carlos Lozada, Pulitzer Prize-winning opinion columnist for the New York Times, co-host of the Matter of Opinion podcast from the Times, and author of the new book, The Washington Read, How to Read Politics and Politicians.
Yesterday was the deadline for Arizonans to register to vote in next month's election. We should know in the coming days the final tally of party affiliation before November. And in case you haven't noticed, and honestly, it'd be pretty tough not to, Arizona is among a handful of swing states in this fall's election. Along with states like Pennsylvania, Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin, Arizona has gotten a lot of attention from candidates and campaigns, not to mention the TV ads, mailings, and texts that go along with that. And Democrats have had more electoral success here in recent years than they've had in the past, winning the top three elected statewide offices 2 years ago and two U.S. Senate seats over the past few years. So we wanted to get a sense of why this is happening. Is Arizona really becoming more purple or even blue, or is something else going on? To talk through this, I spoke earlier with Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting, a Republican, and former State Attorney General Terry Goddard, a Democrat. And we started the conversation with Stan on why Arizona has been such a swing state over the last few election cycles.
Yeah, well, it's good to be here, and I love being here with Terry, and I appreciate, oh, I'm looking forward to his point of view on this. If you want just one short to-the-point answer, I think it's the candidates. That's what I think.
Okay.
Yes, we're changing as a state. Our population is a great deal larger than it used to be, than it was when Bill Clinton last won, way back in 96 or whatever the year was. And it's more diverse as well, but I think those are secondary features in terms of our recent swing state nature. I think it is the Trump phenomenon itself, which we had to get to at one point in this show, is got to be one of the main factors of this. And that's my short answer. And I'm interested in hearing Terry's point of view on that.
Yeah. Well, so Terry, why do you think it has been that Arizona has not only become a swing state, but also there are Democrats? I mean, you were a Democrat elected statewide in the early 2000s, but it's been kind of slim pickings for Democrats statewide since then.
You're telling me? Really? Well, thank you. And I appreciate being here with Stan and the program. But my father was a perpetual optimist and at one time had the misfortune to be chairman of the Democratic Party in Arizona. And every year, every 2 years, he would say, this is the year. We're gonna take it. We're going to win the majority in the legislature. And after a while, I had to just sort of dismiss it as the ravings of a very optimistic and positive person who just wasn't in tune with reality because it didn't happen. And it was year after year after year. But I think there's some things changing, but they may not be Republican-Democrat things that are changing, I think. Hmm. And I interviewed a member of the 25-year-old set, my son, this morning in preparation. And I said, well, what are your colleagues thinking? What are they talking about? And his answer was, well, it's not political parties. You know, Generation Z, millennials are very independent. They're libertarian, I guess, if you could name any particular affiliation. And they're not organizational people. And so what they're looking at is far more issue-oriented, and I think that's reflected by the fact that the majority party now are independents in Arizona. So how do you – what color are the independents? They're not red and they're not blue. And so I think we're moving more in a – I dare say a color of beige or something something that's not either one.
It doesn't get talked about enough, Mark, but Terry's right on point. The 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, Republicans had just over a million registered voters. Democrats had just under a million. And the independent or non-affiliated group was way down in the 200, 300,000 maybe. And fast forward to today, and the major parties are roughly in the same point they always were. But the independent non-affiliated guy is way up above them all.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that all by itself tells you that the point Terry's making is right, is it's not so much a partisan thing. It's a either generational or an attitude thing.
So I want to ask you, Stan, about what you said about candidates. And I wonder if, is it too simplistic to say that the MAGA movement has made Arizona a swing state? Is that too simplistic?
I don't think it's too simplistic to describe the last 8 years, because I think that's an absolute political fact. It's one reason we have a Democratic governor, Democratic attorney general, Democratic secretary of state. The legislature's within one vote of itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's because of this phenomenon happening all around us, of the Trump phenomenon, for good or for ill. It has realigned many things, and that's why we are where we are, I think.
So do you think then that if, for example, Karen Taylor Robeson had won the GOP gubernatorial primary, and let's say there was a U.S. Senate candidate not named Carrie Lake, and more, let's say, a McCain Republican, a Doug Ducey-type Republican, would we be talking about Arizona as a swing state?
I don't think we would, but we're also trying to imagine something that could not exist in those elections. Doug Ducey couldn't win his own primary today, and Carrie Lake just managed to go from gubernatorial television show to gubernatorial nominee to Senate nominee with barely getting out of bed, it seems. It was so easy for her, but she can't win a general election, and that's the phenomenon that's got us in the grip.
And the great county recorder can't get elected in his own party, so
Stephen Richer, yeah.
One of the reasons why we need to think about the partisan primaries as being part of our problem is right there. Now, I think it may go back. I don't want to differ with Stan, because I agree with him about the, if you choose candidates the voters don't like, you're probably not going to get them elected. It may be a little longer than that. I've always thought that I got elected attorney general by my charm and physical beauty. But
yeah, good looks.
Yeah, good looks and hair. Which I used
to go
have.
Too far.
But, the guy I ran against, frankly, had said in writing that women who put their children in daycare should be in prison. And that did not go down well with a lot of voters in Arizona. And then he ended up with his troubles with the state bar. But, if you have the right opponent, you can get elected.
So, Terry, do you agree, though, that if, let's say, there were more quote-unquote mainstream establishment Republican candidates, if there were Doug Ducey's, Karen Taylor Robeson's, those kinds of candidates, would they be winning, and maybe would they be winning easily over Democratic candidates statewide?
Well, not in today's Republican Party. As Stan says, they wouldn't get nominated.
But let's assume that they could get
through.
Well,
then how are you going to do that?
We're talking hypotheticals here.
Let's assume black is white for the moment and go from there. I think Arizona is still — my political hero is a guy named Burton Barr, who was a pragmatist above all else.
Former Speaker of the Arizona House.
Former Speaker of the House, a strong Republican, former career military, and one of the most amazing human beings I've ever known, because he understood what it meant to govern. He relished what it meant to govern. He liked to make things better. And a guy like that, I think, could be elected today, tomorrow, or next. But he couldn't get nominated by the Republican Party in,
86? Yes.
Governor.
He was running for governor.
He was running for governor. He left the legislature. But, boy, he had all the qualifications in the world. So some of this is not new. Sometimes you just don't see the heroes when they're walking among you. But I do think there's some myopia, some MAGA mania, whatever it's called, that has caused some people to be nominated that just can't get elected.
Mark, I think the point you're making is what is Arizona, or the point you're asking, and I say it's still a center-right state. It still is.
Okay.
That if you want to be a statewide Democrat and win the U.S. Senate seat, you have to do what Ruben Gallego's doing right now and running to the right of Carrie Lake on the border, if he can. He's trying to. And you have to be like Kamala Harris is trying to do, talking about tax cuts for the middle class. When's the last presidential candidate on the Democratic side that emphasized that right out of the chute? I mean, to win in Arizona as a statewide Democrat today, you have to be a conservative-oriented person or perceived as such. And that's, I think, we haven't changed in that regard over the last few decades, I believe.
That is Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting. I'm also joined by former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why one dog owner thinks city dogs may not be living their best lives.
But first, let's get back to my conversation with Republican Stan Barnes and Democrat Terry Goddard about Arizona's relatively newfound status as a swing state and why that's happened. And we begin this part of the conversation with Stan and how it sounds like the parties now, and maybe even historically, haven't necessarily represented or been reflective of their members or the population as a whole. So if someone like Doug Ducey couldn't win a GOP primary right now, but the candidates the Republican primary voters are nominating are struggling to win in the general election, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on is the base of each party chooses its winners in the primary system. And it's happening mostly on the Republican side because we see it through the Trump lens. It's also happened a little bit on the Democratic side. I've had friends in the legislature that were conservative Democratic members from the West Valley of Phoenix who were defeated because they weren't Democratic enough or weren't left enough in their own primaries. So it doesn't get as much attention, but both parties are having this polarization pull happening, and they nominate people that can't win. Let's remember, Chris Mays won by, 300 votes or something like that?
It was not a lot.
It was not a lot. And
300 would have been a landslide. Yeah. It was 160.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. It's still close. It's still close despite the fact that the Trump-oriented Republican nominees alienate a great portion of the general election on their way to winning or losing.
Terry, I guess for Democrats, one of the questions is, while they are having success on the statewide level, are they taking advantage of it? Like, are Democrats doing enough in the gubernatorial roles as Secretary of State in the U.S. Senate to show voters that, hey, even if it's not, you know, a MAGA person on the Republican side, that maybe you should vote for Democrats?
Well, unfortunately, a Will Rogers line comes to mind. I mean,
I think I know where you're going with this.
Not part of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah.
So the answer is, I think there's real trying. I mean, Adrian Fontes is a pretty good example of somebody who, as Secretary of State, has really, I think, risen to the occasion and is providing some very dynamic leadership. I think Chris Mays is doing exactly the same thing as Attorney General. I think Katie Hobbs, as a governor, is kind of ruling by consensus. I think she's done well. I think people have reason to be secure in her governorship. And so, yeah, there's some good, solid accomplishment here, and I don't think any big legs of eggs have been laid.
Stan, I want to ask you about something Terry said a couple of moments ago about how especially younger people are less interested in the political party and more interested in specific issues, regardless of what they are. But they care about, issues A, B, and C. How might that sort of further complicate things as we look at where Arizona is politically and the kinds of folks that it elects?
Yeah, when Terry and I were growing up, I'm going to lump us in the same generation. We had three TV stations, and you knew you had to choose one of the two parties.
Right.
But all of our kids can't imagine that kind of formality and constraint, not to mention the phenomenon of social media and all that it's meant to flatten the information silo that we owe all in as young people growing up in the 60s and 70s in Arizona. So all that change around us is just formulaically changed the outcome as well. younger people, I'm going to put under 40, they don't like the straitjacket of the party system.
Well, so, Stan, I guess that raises the question then for Republicans. And I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Matt Salmon, former congressman, former gubernatorial candidate just a couple of years ago, who basically said, as long as Republicans keep nominating the types of candidates that they're nominating, we are going to keep losing elections. And he made the point that in his mind, the Republicans had already hit rock bottom. But he said, maybe not, because we keep nominating these people. So is there a point at which Republicans sort of go back or revert to nominating the John McCain types, the Doug Ducey types, that type of Republican? Or is this something that you think is going to hang around for a while?
I think, to quote Kamala Harris, we're not going back. I don't think the Republicans are going back to anything.
I did not have you quoting Kamala Harris on my bingo card for today, just to point out.
I'm just trying to be entertaining. I think Matt is – I understand where he's coming from. But, I think that's kind of a linear thinking. It's not stagnant. It's always changing. If the Make America Great Again phenomenon ends up being successful in the short term with Trump's reelection and then certain things happen – I can see it playing out to where that's the winning hand in Arizona. So it doesn't have to be. And keep in mind, as I said earlier, it's not like Democrats are crushing it. Now, they are winning races that they might not have won, but they're winning them by a sliver. And it's so much the candidate themselves that makes the difference. And so those variables are not easily just labeled and set for the future.
It's an interesting point, Terry, that Stan makes about the margins, because even with the types of candidates, as he's described, that are not necessarily popular among general election voters, Joe Biden did not win by that many. Katie Hobbs did not win by that much. We talked about Chris Mays's, couple hundred vote margin. So even with sort of these political factors that seems like they would be helpful for Democrats, they're still not – they're winning, but not by a whole lot.
No. That's true. Take Attorney General Mays and ask her about landslides. No, it's a very divided state. Is it moving one way or the other? I think the consensus here is we don't know.
Okay, so let me end with this. There are certain states that, at least in my lifetime, have usually been seen as quote-unquote swing states in presidential elections, if not beyond. Think about a place like Michigan, a place like Pennsylvania, some of those upper Midwestern states. More recently, a place like Nevada has been seen as kind of a swing state. When you look ahead, let's say 2 years, 8 years, 10 years, do either of you see Arizona still in that conversation as being sort of a perpetual swing state, at least as it relates to federal elections?
Actually, I do. And it's not a new phenomenon. I remember back almost in my youth when we were considered, and I believe it's still true in the media, as the almost ideal test market. And so why not make us a state that is in fact somehow indicative of the national feeling? So I think maybe it's a badge of honor.
Yeah, I feel like we are too. I mean, I between demographic changes, our population growth, the fact that we're next door to California but not California, I think we're going to stay there. I would say, what do Harry Truman, Bill Clinton, and Joe Biden have in common? They're the three Democrats that have won Arizona in the last 80 years. And that even when we were very much a Democratic state, Democrats didn't win here as a presidential level. But now here we are, and I feel like anything could happen. And I feel like we're going to stay in the anything can happen category.
All right. Terry Goddard, Stan Barnes, thanks to you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. For Valley True Crime fans, the story of Winnie Ruth Judd, a.k.a. the Trunk Murderess, is Phoenix's claim to infamy. The grisly details of Judd's crime are widely known. In 1931, she killed her two best friends, Anne LeRoy and Sammy Samuelson, stuffed their bodies in a pair of trunks, and rode with them on a train to Los Angeles. Judd was convicted of murder and sentenced to death, but she was determined to be mentally unsound and sent to an asylum. Over the years, she tried repeatedly to escape the asylum before finally being paroled in 1971. She lived her last years quietly back here in Phoenix. The story of the so-called trunk murders has been the subject of various sensational books, articles, and podcasts over the years. But now, writer Lori Nataro has a different version of the story to tell. For her new novel, The Murderess, Nataro spent years poring over previously unknown oral histories and interviews given by Judd in an attempt to capture a more nuanced portrait of the woman behind the crimes. Nataro dedicates a significant portion of her book to Judd's first-person account of her life, from her difficult youth in Indiana to her tortured relationship with her husband. Among other things, Judd was convinced she'd given birth to a son who was subsequently taken from her, an incident which may or may not be true. Nataro spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about the novel and began by reading a passage where Judd recalls the moments after her son's birth.
I had never felt that way before in my life, and I never will again. We were bound together, lashed as one with strings of ferocity, devotion, and elation. In those moments when I first held him, there was nothing I couldn't do. I had the power to vanquish anything. I was almighty and indestructible, and he gave me that. I would give him my love, keep him happy, and deliver him to the world.
I got chills when I read that section of the book, and I am a person without a uterus. Like the experience that she is describing, it's not something I will ever have. And it was particularly powerful in this case because the book is very careful, I think, about the question of whether or not this baby actually exists, mm-hmm. which makes it even more compelling to read that sequence, because one way of looking at it is that she has the ability to convince herself that these are the feelings that she would be having if the baby was real.
Well, you remember, I'm not a mother either. You know, mm-hmm. I don't have children, but mm-hmm. I do know her passion for wanting children. And I tried to feel the way that she would feel, that she had finally gotten to that point in her life where what she wanted to become in her life had finally happened.
That makes a lot of sense, this idea that she viewed having a child as the thing she wanted most in the world, she tells us in that section. And so in the immediate aftermath of this scene, when the baby she believes herself to have had disappears, it does not leave a lot of question in the reader's mind about how somebody who'd just gone through that and felt these emotions that deeply might spin out.
Yeah. Some people believe she was schizophrenic. I don't. I believe that she was bipolar, experiencing manic episodes caused by stress and exacerbated by, in the latter episodes, by drugs and alcohol. Yeah. And there is no help for her. Yeah. And as a result, people died.
That seems like a good segue to talking about her husband, who she mostly refers to in the book as Doctor. And this, I have to say, Lori, was one of the most unexpectedly moving parts of the story for me, because I have personal experience with being in a relationship with somebody who is a survivor of trauma. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is so difficult about it is that there's this part of them that you just can't know. You will never understand it, but you feel the tangible effects of it in your lived experience with them all the time. And there are ways that you realize you can't trust them, no matter how much they try to assure you that you can. And we see this play out between Ruth and her husband over and over again. I had the sense reading the book that you were very interested in that dynamic between the two of them.
I was, because he would be ritually fired again and again. They were constantly moving, and she was constantly having to start over. You know, he was almost 20 years her senior when they got married. She was 19. He was close to 40. And it isn't until her honeymoon that she finds out that he's an addict. He does not trust her with that information until she is locked in. And then he tells her, we can never have children. And that devastates her.
Yeah. Well, and it also means that there are vast stretches of time when they just can't be together, because mm-hmm. he is dealing with his addictions. So he sends her to Phoenix, ostensibly because it's going to be good for her recovery from tuberculosis. But it seems like implicitly, it's also because he knows he can't take care of her.
No.
And the result of that is she's just completely adrift in this burgeoning city where she doesn't know anybody, and she's forced to trust kind of everybody that she meets. Mm-hmm. And that leads her to the character of Jack Halloran, mm-hmm. who, without giving anything away, ends up playing a really deleterious role in her life.
Yeah, he feeds on her.
And it's related to this phenomenon that you describe in the book of summer wives. Was that a real phenomenon?
Oh, absolutely. Men of means who had families would send their wives and children up to Prescott and Flagstaff for the summer so they wouldn't have to suffer in the heat. So that left these men, like Jack Halloran, as kind of like a bachelor, where he was out to play the field. And Ruth, she was in love with him. Jack Halloran, I think, was a miracle for her. This is probably the first love affair she had really ever had. And that's really important for this story. As my friend Robert Palis said, who had investigated the story before I did, he told me in an interview I did with him, this whole thing never would have happened if Jack Halloran had not told Ruth that he loved her.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, as a note to close on, I wonder if you could read me one more passage. It's on page 101, and it really sticks out to me. It comes early-ish in the book, and while most of the book is from the point of view of one or the other of the characters, this part isn't, and I had the sense this is coming from you as a writer. And it's the paragraph that begins, contrary to popular mm-hmm. belief.
I will tell you beforehand that this is one of my favorite passages in the book. And I was asked several times to remove it. People didn't understand. Yeah, they did not understand the connection. And then I said, whoever gets it, gets it. Contrary to popular belief, the most populous plant life in the desert of Phoenix is not a cactus, not a prickly pear, ocotillo, or saguaro. It is the creosote bush, a large, scraggly thing with short, waxy leaves that reflects sunlight and blooms ordinary yellow flowers that are not unsimilar to St. John's wort or any other invasive weed. Its appendages conserve water under drastic circumstances, allowing it to compete aggressively with other plants for resources, and it almost always wins. It thrives with the most meager conditions because it doesn't require much to survive. Whatever genome it was that the creosote descended from, it was stock that was brutal, forceful, and undiscerning. It is basic. It will steal from its neighbors, break them down, and forge on to bloom unremarkably.
Well, Lori Nataro is the author of The Murderess. Lori, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. It's been such a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. There are expected to be 100 million dogs in America by 2030. The canine population here keeps going up, and the culture around dogs keeps changing. Today, they're often just as commercialized as the rest of us, from a $3,000 Gucci dog carrier to Vogue magazine's newest version, catering to dogs, Dog. But our next guest has a different idea of what is essential for dogs. Maddie Butcher is a contributing opinion columnist for The Washington Post who writes about the rural West. And in a recent column, she talks about what dogs really need to run, sniff, play, you know, to be dogs. And she says that's hard for them to do when they're locked up in an apartment or a house for most of the day. Butcher lives in Montezuma County, Colorado, and splits her time between writing and day working for a rancher. That means everything from fixing fences to moving cattle with her dogs. And that's where we began our conversation.
I have three working dogs. One is a young puppy. He's just turning one, and he's coming up with his mentors, as I see it. Older dogs, a 3.5-year-old and a going on an 8-year-old. And they are all border collie mixes. None of them are purebreds. They're kind of known in this area anyway as ranch dogs.
And they work, right? Like, this is part of your work. They are.
Yes, they have a job.
So I want to ask you to sort of set up your argument that you're making here about someone you profile in the piece a little bit, someone who owns a sled dog business, Greg Dubit. Tell us about him and sort of the criticism that he has faced and the criticism that he has.
Greg and his wife are over just east of me by 30 miles or so, and they have 28 sled dogs, and they train their dogs off season, but then during the season they are working them as sled dogs. Most of the dogs stay outside year round and through the four seasons, and those dogs have jobs too. The sled dog community has faced criticism from animal welfare groups like PETA, because as in any industry, there are a few bad apples. There was a sled dog kennel operation that faced some disciplinary action because of poor treatment. And I think, I guess it's inevitable that operations like that will come under scrutiny and some will be bad apples, and rightly so. I mean, you can't neglect or abuse your animals.
Yeah.
However, I think a lot of animal welfare groups may or may not be educated in terms of what those specific dog needs are. And for instance, I'd say most ranch dogs don't need to have a dedicated dog bed or a couch or stay inside. And if you were able to get into a dog's mind and ask them what their best interests are, they'd say, no, I don't want to be inside. and so the disconnect, I think, with a lot of animal welfare groups and a lot of people who are buying accoutrements for their dogs is that they are failing to know the dogs well enough biologically, physiologically, if you want to say psychologically, mm-hmm. know them enough to know actually what their needs and wants are.
Yeah.
And rhinestones is probably not high on a dog's list.
On a dog's list, right. So, I mean, this is so antithetical to the way that we think about our dogs in this country. And you write about, you know, the sort of dog version of Vogue and the amounts of money people are spending on things for their dogs. But beyond that, there's a criticism. What about all these dogs who are locked in houses for a very long time? You have this line in the piece I want to read where you write, towns, cities, and nonprofit animal welfare organizations have done a good job of establishing dog shelters and supporting adoption. This is all good, right? But you write, how many dogs are saved from euthanasia, starvation, neglect, abuse, or exposure only to die of boredom and obesity? Tell us about that.
That line was inspired by a cartoon that I saw years ago. The image of a dog looking out the window and its owners are staring at a TV and slumped on a couch. And the caption is, was I rescued only to die of boredom? Mm. And granted, you know, that's anthropomorphizing itself, obviously.
Right.
But I do think that people get into dog ownership to satisfy very human needs. They feel good because they may have rescued a dog from a pound or a shelter, and yet they go into the dog ownership lacking the education of what dogs really need. And I got an email after that Washington Post column of a woman in downtown Denver who watched, as she called them, young professionals rush out with their dogs on a leash for their 30 minutes of exercise coming out of tiny apartments to the cartoon's endpoint. It's unfortunate that I think a lot of us have put their interests and a certain lack of knowledge in front of the best interests of the dog.
Right. So what you're kind of talking about, and you mentioned this earlier in the conversation, is this idea of putting yourself inside the dog's head a little bit and understanding those breeds, what they were bred for, what they are kind of meant to do. Tell us a little bit about that. Like your dogs, as an example, tell us about how they were bred, what they are meant to do, and what they would be like if they lived in a city in an apartment and got 30 minutes outside a day.
So border collies and stock dogs in general, they have a very strong drive to move prey animals, specifically anything from sheep to ducks to goats to cows. In terms of a dog that has that drive in the city, like where is the outlet for that? And as I mentioned in the Washington Post piece, pretend jobs are fine.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think I would own a stock dog if I lived in the city, but if I had one, I would give it jobs, whether it meant herding my cat around or herding ducks around in my backyard to running with it, or just games of fetch, or something that stimulates not only its mind, but its body.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, and this is a tough question, but you're getting at it here, right? Like, so, you know, hundreds of millions of people have dogs in America, and we love them in a way, and maybe we don't understand them, maybe we aren't doing it right, but are there ways in which you can live in urban America with a dog and do it well and, like, care about the dog's needs, even though they may need to be in an apartment for many hours a day?
That's a really good question. I would do research around what dog is best suited to that. It certainly wouldn't be a sport dog or a working dog. And that's hard to do in the rural West, for instance. Even if you go to the shelter, almost all the dogs are working dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you really have to balance your interest in helping, in adopting and rescuing, with a certain level of education around not what's going to be good for me, the human, but what's going to be good for this specific dog. The main pushback that I feel like Phoenix listeners would be giving me is that we simply cannot get outside, and we don't have open space, and we don't have a climate that is amenable to lots of racing around. And I would say, okay, let's try to be part of the solution, which would be something indoor, perhaps, you know, a big open arena with AstroTurf, and an understanding that dog owners are going to pick up after their dogs, as well as, you know, something that has water where they can cool off. But I guess that I tend to look at dog ownership problems as challenges that can be overcome, and you know, where there's a will, there's a way.
All right, we will leave it there. That is Maddie Butcher, a contributing opinion columnist for The Washington Post, who writes about the rural West. She's author of the book Horsehead, Brain Science and Other Insights. Maddie, thank you for coming on to talk about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and good luck with your canines.
Twenty-five years ago, filmmaker Wim Wenders released an Oscar-nominated documentary called Buena Vista Social Club. The film introduced a generation of Americans to some of the most revered musicians in Cuba, some of whom were in their 90s and still performing. An album of songs from the documentary went on to sell more than 8 million copies. Jesus Ramos was one of the musicians featured on that album. Today, he's the trombonist and bandleader of the Buena Vista Orchestra. The group is currently on tour playing music from the documentary, as well as original compositions inspired by its legacy. As Ramos told the show last week through an interpreter, performing the songs is a way of keeping the spirit of those legendary musicians alive.
When he's playing, it's something very emotional because it brings back like memories of all the people that taught him to play something. So then he sees like the audience dancing, and that's like paying a homenaje to the people, like honoring those musicians that taught him that are no longer here.
Ramos himself is in his 70s now and says playing music is what keeps him alive.
Por la música.
Yeah.
Si no tuviera la música, sí. Ni respirara, vaya.
So that he breathes music, and if there was no music, like, he wouldn't be breathing. Like, he always knew it was going to be music from a young age, and that it's the only thing he's always wanted to do.
Jesus Ramos and the Buena Vista Orchestra are performing in Phoenix tonight at the Celebrity Theater.
All right, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. And of course, we'll be back with you again tomorrow with more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.